This is the Does God Exist Bi-Monthly Journal for May-June 2013 for the visually impaired. John Clayton is your reader. This particular issue of our bi-monthly publication has a picture on the cover of a large iguana. And the lead article and the title of the bi-monthly for this issue is A Visit to the Galapagos Islands. There are many famous places throughout the world where the location provided mankind with conditions that led to major discoveries. Yellowstone National Park has given us an opportunity to study and understand how volcanic areas can have water moving in and around the magmas that produce the heat, and this has led to many understandings of how mineral resources are produced. Okefenokee Swamp in southern Georgia has led us to understand how anaerobic conditions, and meaning without oxygen, could produce coal and peat. Death Valley in California and the Great Salt Lake in Utah have taught us how evaporite deposits can form, such as the ones under Detroit, Michigan. Perhaps no area is more famous, however, than the Galapagos Islands. The Galapagos Islands are located some 600 miles west of the coast of Ecuador. They were made famous by the studies and work of Charles Darwin, who visited the islands in 1835 at the age of 26, and did exhaustive studies of the flora and fauna of the area. His studies led to some understandings which violated the religious traditions of his day. They also were seized upon by some philosophers to justify a belief system that rejected God and depended on naturalism as a faith upon which they lived their lives. My visit to the Galapagos Islands was made possible by a wonderful medical missions program called Operation Ecuador. And you can have contact with them if you wish on www.operationecuador.org. Operation Ecuador is directed by Kent and Joshua Markham. They send medical mission teams into the bush to address the physical needs of indigenous people living in the interior of Ecuador. They also operate the Quito School of Biblical Studies, minister to a large congregation in Quito, and operate a school and care facility for children called the Hacienda of Hope and Camp Bellevue. My visit was to teach in all of these works and then to accompany returning medical mission workers to the Galapagos, where they could recover from their work and we would learn together and see the basis of the work of Charles Darwin. In 1959, the Galapagos National Park was created and the Charles Darwin Foundation was formed under the sponsorship of UNESCO. In 1964, the Charles Darwin Research Station was established, and in 1978, the Galapagos Islands were declared a World Heritage Site, and 7 years later, a World Biosphere Reserve. What that means is that the islands are being protected and a strong effort is being made to keep them unchanged by human invasion. This has been quite successful, as there is very little trash or destruction by humans visible in the areas we visited. The reason that I have always wanted to visit the Galapagos Islands is because evolution has been used as a club by so many skeptics and atheists against belief in God and acceptance of the Bible as His Word. In our ministry, we have maintained that science and faith are friends and not enemies, and that science supports the biblical record. We have also maintained that since the same God who created all living things also gave us the biblical record, no scientific fact can conflict with what the Bible says. If there is a conflict, I believe it is because we either have bad science or bad theology or both. Going to the Galapagos and seeing what Darwin saw and studying what Darwin actually said and believed is a critical part of answering challenges to the biblical account. One of the first points that becomes apparent to any visitor to the Galapagos Islands who looks at the night sky is that the astronomy of the Galapagos is as interesting as the biology. In the Galapagos, away from city lights and pollution, one can get a full picture of the majesty of God's creation in the heavens. You can see the Milky Way clearly. We could see Jupiter, Mars, and Saturn clearly. We could observe the Magellanic Clouds, that's dwarf galaxies visible from the southern hemisphere, and spot the area where supernova 1987A exploded in 1987. That was the first such sighting since the Chinese saw the Crab Nebula explosion in 1054 AD. God's crucible to produce the heavier elements of which life is made is very clear when you are lucky enough to have a totally cloudless sky. Darwin's discussions were about biology, not the creation of the cosmos. The Galapagos are located on the equator. While we were in Quito, we went to see the Museo de Sitio Intinian, and I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, in which exhibits and demonstrations teach the uniqueness of being at the equator. We watched water go down the drain instead of spiraling down, and talked about the Coriolis force, which affects how water behaves. We tried to balance an egg on a nail and talked about why that is possible at the equator. We talked about how much less we weigh at the equator than we do at the poles. That's due to centrifugal force. But even though there was some trickery involved in some of the exhibits, the fact that the Earth is unique in its design is apparent. The message is that nothing Darwin did has anything to do with the actual creation of the Earth. The creation of time, space, and matter energy is not what Darwin was studying. What Darwin was studying was the question of how animals came to be as we see them today. There are 13 species of finches scattered throughout the 13 main islands, 6 small islands, and 42 islets, where detailed studies of the finches have been conducted. One species also exists in Costa Rica. Bible teachers in Darwin's time maintained that God created each of the 13 species independently and placed them where they live today. In addition to the finches, there are iguanas, which are not only found in the Galapagos, but also in Mexico, Fiji, Tonga, South Africa, and the Caymans, just to name a few. These various iguanas are separate species because they cannot interbreed. Since they are members of the saurian family, they are reptiles and must maintain their body temperature by exposure to the sun. The Galapagos island iguanas, which grow to be 3 feet long, are infertile with the Galapagos marine iguanas. The marine iguanas feed on algae on the floor of the ocean and have a gland in their respiratory system that collects excess salt in their bodies and sneezes it away. Even the huge Galapagos tortoises, which can weigh over 500 pounds, are different on each island and infertile with the tortoises on other islands. There was much conversation when we were there because Lonesome George, a gigantic male from one island, had recently died. His body was being shipped out to be preserved by a taxidermist because he was the last one of his species of tortoises to survive, being incapable of producing offspring with the other tortoises. Today, our studies of DNA and the genomes of living things have shown how close these animals are to each other genetically. The incredible wisdom built into their DNA allows them to adapt and become unique for a particular environment. The research being done at the Charles Darwin Research Center is helping mankind understand how to control and protect all forms of life on this planet. Again, in Darwin's day, the claim of most theologians would have been that God created each tortoise separately and placed each one on its island, and that they were unchanged to this day. What Darwin maintained was that there was a design system built into the animals which allowed them to change to fit the physical conditions in which they found themselves. Since genetics was not a functional science at that time, Darwin had no idea what the design feature was that allowed this natural change, but he maintained it was the explanation for the finches and iguanas and tortoises. What was going on theologically in Darwin's day is essentially what is going on today. People had decided that the Bible was too radical to be believed. Not only did people not want to follow the Bible's teachings, but they considered it to be primitive ignorance to suggest that Genesis was true. If they had investigated the word kind in the Hebrew of Genesis, they would have seen that it is a very broad term. Paul in 1 Corinthians 15:39 spells out what kind means. Quote, "There is one kind of flesh of man, another flesh of beast, another of fishes, and another of birds." End of quote. This same breakdown is used in Genesis 1, when the flesh of fish, verse 20, part A, and the flesh of birds, verse 20, part B, the flesh of beast, verse 24, and the flesh of man, verses 26 and 27, are used. We now know that the genome of the iguanas contains enough stored information to allow the iguanas to live in a marine or land environment. The design of the genome is a fantastic demonstration of God's wisdom and design, allowing the finches to live in every ecological niche the Galapagos has to offer. Even the tortoises have subtle physical characteristics that enable them to reproduce and live in particular habitats. What impressed me about the work going on in the research stations we visited was that it was good science and not speculative theories and philosophies. Researchers were not looking for a link between the finches and the iguanas. They were concerned with understanding how the natural history of the Galapagos had shaped and was being shaped by the forms of life that exist there. In talking with researchers, I encountered no one who felt there was a conflict between what they were doing and faith in God and the Bible. We had a guide assigned to our boat by the governmental agencies. He was very knowledgeable and expressed some wonderment that anyone would even suggest that somehow this area that he knew so well would be considered an area contributing to doubts about God and the Bible. As we traveled from island to island, we were able to see incredible numbers of birds. Blue-footed boobies, which could dive at incredible speeds to get fish. Cormorants, which cannot fly. Flamingos, frigate birds who would steal fish from the other birds. Stilts, penguins, pelicans, hawks, and gulls. Each had special equipment, ideally suited to the islands where they live. We got to scuba dive and saw some of the 307 fish species, plus sea lions and rays. On our last day, we visited a bay nestled in the mangroves where dozens of giant sea turtles were grouped for mating. It is still a mystery as to what happens to the baby turtles from the time when they hatch to when they become large enough to safely swim in the open sea. We have so much to learn about how God has designed and created the earth and its living creatures. I recommend the Galapagos highly for those who wish to see what it was like when God said, quote, "It is good." There is no reason to fear that one's faith will be destroyed, because the beauty and wisdom of God shines as brightly in the Galapagos as any place on this planet. Darwin's findings conflicted with the theology of organized religion in his day, but not with what God's word actually says. It is sad that in our day, people have taken Darwin's work and attempted to exclude God from our thought processes as we study the earth. Was Jesus married? In September of 2012, an announcement was made that a fragment of ancient papyrus had been found by Dr. Karen King, Hollis Professor of Divinity at Harvard University, proving that Jesus Christ had a wife. The story was on the front page of the Denver Post on September 20, 2012, and was promoted by Diane Sawyer the same night and run on Yahoo by Aaron McLaughlin. Our interest in this claim is not so much whether the claim is true or not, although we will explore that question, but more concerned with how we approach claims like this and how we answer people who are disturbed by such media presentations. There have been several reactions from church members when a claim like this is given wide publicity. Some function from a position of denial. They either ignore the stories completely or assume it is a liberal plot to destroy Christianity, and if it is ignored, it will just go away. For others, the reaction is out-and-out apathy. Quote, "Nothing can change my mind," end of quote, is the verbal response, and it is assumed that this is all that is needed. A third reaction by church members is fear. When this story came out, I had a call from a woman who was in tears and cried in a loud voice, "What are we going to do?" as if the world was ending with this announcement. Actually, this last reaction is more constructive than the other two. In 1 Peter 3:15, we read, quote, "Be ready always to give an answer to every man that ask you of the reason of the hope that is within you with meekness and fear," end of quote. Christians have to be concerned not only with their own understanding of issues like this, but also concerned about how these issues affect others, their families, their children especially, their friends, and their neighbors. There are two major approaches to this situation. One approach is fetishism, which is belief without examining evidence. Many atheists practice fetishism in that they will accept anything that discredits religion or especially that discredits the church. Many atheists, including some masquerading as church members, really don't want to believe in God because they know it will mean a change in their lives. So they summarily reject anything that might support the validity of the church or of religion in general. Many people in the church have an inherited faith. They believe, or at least participate, because their parents or maybe their grandparents believed and practiced a certain set of beliefs. They really don't have faith. They have acceptance. This means their involvement with the work of the church will be minimal at best. Let me just give you a hypothetical picture of this belief system and how illogical it is. Let's assume a man is brought before a judge for a crime. The dialogue between the judge and the defense lawyer goes something like this. The lawyer says, quote, "My client is innocent," end of quote. The judge says,
Why is he innocent?
The lawyer says, because I believe he's innocent. The judge says, well, what evidence do you have that he is innocent? And the lawyer says, I don't need any evidence. I just know it in my heart. Who would accept such a defense? Certainly, the bright young people in our high schools and colleges won't accept it. The second major approach to this issue is evidentialism. In the words of Anthony Flew, the famous atheist who left atheism after having been a spokesman for atheism for years, quote, you have to follow the evidence wherever it leads, end of quote. By the way, our November-December 2010 issue on page 12 had an article about Anthony Flew. In the words of Jesus Christ, quote, ask, and it shall be given to you. Seek, and you shall find. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you. For everyone who asks receives, and he that seeks finds. And to him that knocks, it shall be opened. End of quote, Matthew 7 and verse 7. This isn't talking about material wealth. The context of the passage is finding answers and making good judgments. In John 15:26, Jesus promised, when the Counselor comes, whom I will send to you from the Father, the Spirit of truth who goes out from the Father, he will testify about me. In 2 Timothy 3:16, 17, we are told that Scripture was given so that the man of God may be thoroughly equipped for every good work, end of quote. Jesus always referred his listeners to evidence, both in his parables and in references from the Bible. Notice passages like Matthew 21:42, quote, have you read the Scriptures? End of quote. And in Matthew 22, verse 29, quote, you are in error because you do not know the Scriptures, end of quote. Luke 24, 27, Jesus says, quote, he explained to them what was said in all the Scriptures concerning himself, end of quote. Christians should welcome evidence and equip themselves to deal with it to the best of their ability. Let us take this story about Jesus being married and talk about how we approach the claim and what answer we give about it. We first go back to the original article written by Dr. King. The article is 52 pages long and is a factual statement of a papyrus which she has studied. Dr. King says, this find provides no reliable historical information about the historical Jesus, end of quote. It is called a, quote, gospel, end of quote, by the press because it appears to be a page from a book. Dr. Elaine Pagels of Princeton, who is an expert in this area of study, said she could find no reason to call it a gospel, except to make it sound more important. The fragment under question is written in ancient Coptic, an Egyptian language. The papyrus is very old, dating back to 300 AD, and contains grammar like the Coptic people used in the 200s and 300s. It is written on both sides of a papyrus that is about the size of a business card, and contains fragments of eight lines on the front as follows. First line, quote, not to me, my mother gave to me life. The second line, the disciple said to Jesus, I, the third line, deny, period. Mary is worthy of it. The fourth line, quote, Jesus said to them, my wife, fifth line, she will be able to be my disciple. The sixth line, let wicked people swell up. The seventh line, as for me, I dwell with her in order to. And the eighth line has an image. If the document were written in modern ink or made reference to modern things, we could summarily reject it. This has been the case in some claims, but it is not the case here. To evaluate this claim, we have to look at the situation in the world at the time the fragment was written as a starting point for our evaluation. At that time, the Gnostic teaching had grown with all of its false claims. The so-called Gospel of Thomas was written about that time and has the same style as this fragment. The Gnostics believed that Jesus married Mary Magdalene, and the Book of Thomas has all kinds of statements about it. For example, the document says, quote, every woman who makes herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven, end of quote. So Gnostics believed that women had to become men in order to be saved. The line in question in the King fragment says, quote, Jesus said to them, my wife, and then it says, she will be able to be my disciple. The rest of the lines are not present. Assuming that being the wife of Jesus in order to be a disciple was the issue doesn't fit well with the teachings of Jesus. But it does fit well with the tradition of the Gnostics. There are many professors in the academic world who are convinced the document has no credibility. Dr. Wolf Peter Funk, who is an authority on early Christian manuscripts, says, quote, Some guy in the first or second century decided to write the words, quote, my wife, end of quote, and put them in Jesus' mouth, end of quote. King admits that her first reaction to the fragment was, quote, this is highly likely to be a forgery, end of quote. There are a lot of people in the academic world who don't believe this discovery will stand up under closer examination. That brings us to the point of how well this fragment fits the rest of the New Testament. First of all, the Bible is silent about whether Jesus had a wife. The Roman Catholic Church has always maintained that Jesus was celibate, so the reaction from the Vatican was fairly predictable. When Jesus was near death on the cross, it was his mother that he expressed concern for and committed to the care of John. See John 19:26-27. If Jesus was married, his wife's situation would have been even more critical than his mother, since he did have brothers and sisters who could care for Mary. Being the oldest son, however, gave him a special responsibility. And if he had a wife, that would have been true of his care for his wife as well. The concept of Jesus being God who came to the earth and dwelt among men, John 1:14, doesn't fit well with Jesus having a wife. The mission that Jesus was on was all-consuming. Luke 19:10 tells us that, quote, the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost, end of quote. Putting that together with, quote, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no man comes to the Father but by me, end of quote, John 14:6, and, quote, salvation is found in no other name under heaven, end of quote, Acts 4:12, it is difficult to justify Jesus living with a woman and being involved in the day-to-day work and care for a family. Also, the scriptures indicate that the church is the bride of Christ, Revelation 19:7, Revelation 21:2, and 9, as well as other passages. The evidence is that Jesus did not have a wife. We take this current media sensationalism as an example of what happens daily to young people on the web. Individually, we may not have the time to research every claim that is made, but there are journals like this one that do analyze the claims. Working together, we can, quote, give an answer to anyone who asks of the hope that is within us, 1 Peter 3:15. We can also encourage our young people to be evidentialist and to go where the evidence leads them. By the way, the quotations of the fragment are from Smithsonian Magazine, November 2012, page 74. What can we learn from Genesis 1 and 2? This is a guest article by Dr. Philip Eichmann. In the first two chapters of Genesis, we find two accounts of God's creative ability, Genesis 1:26-31 and Genesis 2:4-25. The first account describes the creation of the universe, life on earth, and human beings from a broad cosmic perspective. The second account is more personal and adds additional details about the creation of human beings. The accounts are brief, and there is so much more that we would like to know, but there is still important information in these chapters about God and his creation. Some preliminary thoughts on Genesis 1-2. When we approach the Genesis account of creation, it is good to keep several thoughts in mind. Some of these include the following. Number one, Genesis is a very ancient document. Genesis is thousands of years old and comes from a very different time and place. For this reason, it is important to take into consideration the historical and cultural background, language, and literary style when interpreting the book. Point number two, the primary purpose of the Genesis account was theological. Genesis was originally written to the Hebrew people and gave them a theological foundation for their faith and a basis for their religion. Genesis set God apart from the pagan gods of polytheism and explained God's role in the universe. The accounts also explain the relationship between God and human beings, and the place of humans in the world that God created. Number three, Genesis was written to be understood by people of many different social, cultural, and technological backgrounds. Genesis was written in simple, straightforward language that could be understood by people of many different backgrounds living over a period of thousands of years. Number four, Genesis contains only a summary of God's creative activities. Genesis was not intended to be an exhaustive account. What we do have is an outline or a sketch of the actual events. Genesis may not give us all the details, but there is enough information upon which to base our faith in God as the Creator. Number five, there is more than one possible interpretation of the Genesis account. Several interpretations of the Genesis account have been proposed. This reminds us that interpreting a passage like Genesis is not an easy task, and we need to be patient in trying to come to the best and most reasonable interpretation. What does Genesis 1 and 2 tell us about creation? Volumes have been written in an attempt to answer this question, but only a few brief comments will be given here. In doing so, we need to allow Genesis to speak to us rather than forcing our personal opinions on the text. It is necessary for properly interpreting any biblical passage, and Genesis is no exception. If we allow Genesis to speak to us, we will see several important points about the creation. Here are some of them. Number one, there was a beginning. Science cannot explain the existence of matter, but most scientists will affirm that the universe had a beginning. This agrees with the first verse in Genesis that describes the beginning of the physical universe. Number two, there is no time reference in Genesis 1 and 2. Exactly when the beginning occurred is not specified. Therefore, the age of the universe or the date of creation was not given in the Genesis account. In the past, some individuals have tried to calculate a date for the creation from genealogies, but this method is questionable. Scientists have given an age for the universe in the range of billions of years, but this has worried some who believe in the Genesis account. The God described in the Bible, however, is eternal and exists outside of time. Such a creator could have formed the universe either billions of years ago or last week. It does not matter, because God is not limited by time. Number three, there are at least two types of creative activity by God. One of the original Hebrew words used in Genesis, bara, was used to describe the direct creation of something. This word is used in the Old Testament only in reference to God and is translated as create or created. The word is found in Genesis 1:1, 1:21, 1:27, and 5:12, where it refers to the creation of matter, creation of conscious life, and the creation of human beings. There are other words or phrases that describe further creative acts. Genesis 1:2 seems to suggest that the initial creation was not complete and required further creative activity by God. These additional creative acts can be identified usually by the phrase, quote, let there be, end of quote, or simply the word let. If you're interested in that, see, for example, 1:3, 1:6, 1:9, 1:11, 1:14, and 1:20. In each of these examples, God is further shaping or forming the basic created matter after the initial creation. Number four, there were specific periods or days of creative activity. These creative periods of time provide a basic outline of God's activities. Are these literal 24-hour days, or could they have been longer periods of time? The Hebrew word for day, yom, y-o-m in Hebrew, can have several meanings. These include a 24-hour day, a period of light during the 24-hour day, or a time period of undetermined length. Some Hebrew scholars have pointed out that it is not possible to determine from the context of Genesis whether the word yom refers to a 24-hour day or a very long period of time. Some believe that the phrase evening and morning indicates a 24-hour day. In Hebrew, however, this is an idiomatic expression, meaning the beginning and ending of a period of time, and can refer to a period of time other than a literal 24-hour day. Thus, the exact length of these periods is really a matter of interpretation. Number five, God created various kinds of living things. Historically, there have been problems when the biblical term kind was interpreted as a type of biological classification. The word kind is not the same as species. Species is a word that is defined by science and not used at the time that Genesis was written. Kind is a much less specific term used in Hebrew to describe a small or a large group of living things. See, for example, 1:11, 1:21, and 1:24. For this reason, it is probably best to think of kinds as groups of organisms that God created. Number six, human beings are a part of God's creation. Both accounts in Genesis indicate that human beings were created separately from the other animals and were fully human and possessing all of the characteristics that we associate with human beings. Genesis 1:26-27, Genesis 2:7, and Genesis 2:18-24. There was no indication that humans evolved from lower forms, or that the man and woman were created in a less than human form. Number seven, human beings are a part of the biological world, Genesis 2:7. Genesis tells us that human beings were formed from the dust of the earth, Genesis 2:7. For this reason, our physical bodies are made up of the same elements that make up other living things, as well as non-living things such as air, water, rocks, stars, and planets. Because humans are made of the elements of the earth and were a part of the creation of all life on earth, there are certain characteristics that we share with other living things. Genesis tells us that, quote, God breathed the breath of life, end of quote, into man that he had created, Genesis 2:7. The term breath of life is used in reference to other animals, as well as human beings, Genesis 7, 21-22. This can perhaps be thought of as biological life, and is something that we share with other living things. This is why many of the chemical processes that take place within the cells of our bodies are similar to those found in other living things. Also, like other animals, humans have a biological life that ends in death, and a physical body that returns to the earth. Number 8, human beings bear the image and likeness of God. Unlike the other creatures that God formed, humans alone were made in the image of God, Genesis 1:26, 27, and also 5:1 and 9:6. It is this God-likeness that sets humans apart from the biological world and gives humans a distinction and status in the creation. The image of God that we possess gives us our spiritual dimension and makes each human being a person similar to the way in which God is a person. Humans are personal creatures and have personality because God is a personal being and has personality. Human beings were also created by God with the capacity and responsibility to act morally, Genesis 2:16 through 17. This is a part of the image and likeness of God, which each human being possesses. Humans are free moral agents and must make decisions and act according to moral principles. Some may choose to deny this and live as if there is no such thing as right or wrong, but that is a choice that they must make. The conclusion. The Genesis account tells us that when God finished with his creation, he, quote, saw that it was good. This phrase was repeated several times in Genesis 1, and each time it is used in reference to some aspect of God's creation. In Genesis 1, verses 4 and 10 and 12 and 18, 21, 25, and 31. The phrase, God saw that it was good, tells us something about God's creative acts. The original creation was in a state of well-being, and there were natural laws in place that maintained and sustained the universe that God had made. Modern science began with the assumption that the universe and the laws governing it were created by God, and most of the early scientists were Christians, or at least held a theistic worldview with God as the creator in the center. For many today, the theistic worldview has been replaced with a naturalistic worldview in which man is the center and the natural process is the dominant force in the universe. For these individuals, the universe is no longer seen as a product of God's creation, but rather the result of unguided natural processes. For Christians, however, the first two chapters of Genesis continue to provide information about the universe and a basis for faith in God as its creator. Great scientist and God. Our great scientist for this issue is Michael Faraday, who lived from 1791 to 1867. He was the founder of electronics and electromagnetics. And this is what Faraday had to say. Quote, "The book of nature which we have to read is written by the finger of God. I bow before him who is Lord of all and hope to be kept waiting patiently for his timer and mode of releasing me according to his divine word, and the great and precious promises whereby his people are made partakers of the divine nature. Think for a moment, brethren of the Church of Christ, what it means and what it ought to be. Where the word of God has sounded, there his people are drawn together, in small companies, and we may consider that there are many such scattered over the world of whom we know nothing, gathered out of the world, to the obedience of all things that Christ has commanded. And though the thought of death brings the thought of judgment, which is far above all the trouble that arises from breaking of mere earthly ties, it also brings to the Christian the thought of him who died, was judged, and who rose again for the justification of those who believe in him. And therefore, brethren, we ought to value the privilege of knowing God's truth far beyond anything we can have in this world. The more we see the perfection of God's law fulfilled in Christ, the more we ought to thank God for his unspeakable gift." Cynthia's Corner. Our trip to Ecuador and the Galapagos Islands was a faith-building experience we'll always treasure. The congregation in Quito operates an accredited Bible studies program, training preachers and Christian workers from all over South America. John was honored to teach classes for them and to speak to the congregation on Sunday morning. In addition to their community work in Quito and beyond, the congregation operates an orphanage and a Christian school in the northern province. The school is changing many young lives by giving them a good education, a stable and loving home life, and a foundation of faith in God and the Bible. To our delight, John was asked to speak to the school children too. We were impressed with their intelligence, enthusiasm, and desire to learn. The school is located at just over 11,000 feet above sea level, and the drive to the school gave us a chance to see the beauty of the Andes Mountains and the countryside. Our next adventure was to rendezvous with a medical missions team that had just come out of the Ecuadorian jungle and go to the Galapagos Islands for rest and relaxation with fellow Christians. The medical mission team had just spent two arduous weeks in the interior jungle treating the sick, helping the poor, and ministering to all who had physical and or spiritual needs. It was physically and emotionally draining, but they did it with joy and gratitude because of their convictions about obeying God and serving others. It was inspiring and motivating to be with them and all the Christians working in Ecuador to serve families and communities and to teach people about God and Jesus and His Word. These Christians were living their convictions, and it was a joy to be with them. We listened to John's discussions about the islands, and in the evenings gathered on the top deck of the ship to sing hymns and spiritual songs, pray together, and share lessons about all the things we had seen during the day that spoke of God's wisdom and design in the world around us, Romans 1:19-20. On top of that, we had above us the most awe-inspiring, magnificent, star-studded sky you'll ever see, Psalms 19:1. How blessed we are to have experienced spiritual and sensual feasts like this. We are thankful to God and to all Christians who are putting their faith into practice, Matthew 7:24, and making this a better world to live in. That's from Cynthia Clayton. Dandy Designs, How Do Plants See? One of the most fascinating areas of study in botany is how plants think and how they see. We normally associate thinking and seeing with the brain. While there are people who talk to their plants and believe the plants can respond to what they say, research doesn't support such claims. What research does show, however, is that plants do seem to sense the presence of other plants, and that they seem to know when to germinate and when to flower. Studies have shown that if a plant is being shaded by another plant, it will restrict its development of new shoots and will accelerate stem growth so it can get an upper hand in securing more light. Another major mystery is how plants know when to flower. Not all plants flower in the spring. When a plant flowers, always seems to be when it can best provide and produce seeds for successful production of new plants. Research has shown that plants do all these things by dissecting light. Sunlight has all of the colors of the rainbow in it, and plants break the light up into these colors. What a plant doesn't use, it reflects, and since green is the highest energy reaching the surface of the earth, reflecting green protects the plant from too much radiation. That is why plants look green to us. Plants absorb the very long wavelengths of light, including infrared, which our eyes cannot see. The infrared penetrates leaves. So by detecting the fact that red doesn't get to the plant and infrared does, the plant knows it is in the shade and sends up more stem material to get to the sunlight. This same technique allows seeds to know when to germinate and tells the plant when to flower. This oversimplified explanation shows us clearly that even though the plant doesn't have a brain, the system is highly designed, fine-tuned, and incredibly complex, indicating that intelligence was involved in producing it. There is remarkable design in plants, and that design requires a designer to not only understand the system, but be able to use it to the best possible extent. The data for this article incidentally came from the Natural History Magazine, September 2004, page 32. Plant smells. The more science learns about plants, the more we are amazed at what we see designed into them. One of those things is the use of smell. We may not have thought about it too much, but smell depends upon chemicals. When you smell something, whether it is pleasant or noxious, it is actually chemicals in the air secreted by the plant or animal that you are detecting. The way that plants use chemicals and the sense of smell is incredible. Humans have used perfumes as attractants for a long time, and plants do that as well. Smell is more efficient than color for attracting bees, wasps, flies, butterflies, beetles, moths, birds, bats, and even mice. A plant has a fragrance because that smell attracts pollinators that allow the plant to fertilize and produce seeds. Each plant has a different chemical compound it uses as its attractant. In some cases, only one kind of insect or moth is attracted to that chemical, so the smell becomes very specific as to who the pollinator will be. Another plant smell that is rather incredible is the smell that is used in what researchers call, quote, negative communicators, end of quote. A good example is the lima bean. Lima bean plants are attacked by spider mites. Spider mites are eaten by carnivorous mites. When the lima bean is attacked by spider mites, it floods the area with a chemical signal which attracts the carnivorous mites and causes other lima bean plants to emit the same chemical. When the spider mites have all been eaten, the plant ceases secreting the chemical. Squash plants have a similar system. As we work towards being able to feed the human population on this planet, we have to be aware of the special properties of plants and the design and intelligence that is built into these living systems. Truly we can know, quote, that there is a God through the things he has made, end of quote, Romans 1 and verse 20. The data for this incidentally came from National Geographic, February 2004. News and notes. Asteroids and meteors. We have been reminded of how carefully God has designed the Earth when astronomical incidents occur, such as the meteor explosions over Russia on February 15, 2013, the same day that an asteroid made a near pass of Earth. In December of 2013, a comet will make a major appearance in the night sky, and this will start the publicity of astronomical collisions all over again. These objects are all debris left over from the formation of the solar system and changes that have happened within it. The huge magnitude of these forces was emphasized when the shock wave of the meteor caused massive glass breakage in Russia, which injured people. The meteor was just a chunk of rock measured in feet, not an asteroid measured in miles. Most asteroids are between Mars and Jupiter, and our atmosphere burns up virtually all of the objects that are near us. The still larger objects, like comets coming from outer space, are swept away from us by the gravity of our large planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Neptune, and Uranus. Life on Earth is special and tenuous, and without the careful design of our solar system and the Earth within it, we would not survive. The comet is coming! A newly discovered comet named Ison has been discovered and will swing by the Earth in November of this year. This appears to be brighter than any comet that has been seen since 1680, being as bright as a full moon. The last time we had a bright comet was when Marshall Applegate led his Heaven's Gate cult group to commit mass suicide in 1997, supposedly so that it could catch a ride on it. A comet is simply debris left over from the production of the solar system. What will be unique about this one is its brightness. But an ignorant public is likely to attach all kinds of weirdness to its appearance. The data for this, by the way, is from the week, January 25th, 2013, if you want to read about it. Planet count up to 2740. Using the Kepler telescope, astronomers now have evidence that 2,740 planet-like objects orbit other stars in our galaxy. Only a small section of the sky has been surveyed, but the ratio seems to be that 1/6 of the stars we can see have planets in orbit around them. That number will certainly be reduced as new analysis is done, but the fact remains that the process that produced the galaxy produced a variety of planets around many stars. It is possible that life could exist on some of them if God saw fit to create life there. The Bible does not say that this is the only place God created life. Like most of science, this is an interesting and practical area of research that may influence our future. But it is not a concern to those interested in the existence of God or the validity of the Christian system. Data for this is from the week, January 25th, 2013, page 17. Lamarck versus Darwin again. In the 18th century, a French naturalist named Jean-Baptiste Lamarck proposed that organisms could pass along biological traits they had acquired during their lifetimes. At the start of the 20th century, an experiment was done that involved cutting the tails off of mice to show that their offspring were not tailless, as Lamarck had suggested. Lamarckian evolution was pretty much discarded. Now, a new field called epigenetics is being developed, which is the study of how individual genes may be activated or deactivated by life experiences. and how 1% of these changes can get passed on to offspring. This is a far cry from Lamarck's theory, but it has significance in understanding cancer and autism and diabetes. In a related report, a project called ENCODE has 442 scientists studying the genetic activity in 147 different types of human cells to provide a comprehensive look at the roles played by genes not involved in protein building. Project leader Iwan Burney says, quote, "I think it's going to take this century to fill out all the details," end of quote. The complexity built into the genetic makeup of life is astounding, and we have so much more to learn about its design and function that one has to marvel at the intelligence which structured it to begin with. If you're interested in this, there's more information in Discover the Year in Science 2012 and also in The Week, January 25th, 2013, page 9. Human evolution complexity. Scientists trying to put together a workable model of the physical evolution of man are starting to question whether it will ever be possible to identify our last common ancestor. And that last statement is a quote from Scientific American, February 13, page 44. In the same issue, there's a chart titled Our Tangled Family Tree, end of quote, which shows all the problems involved in the fossils that have been found and how they are interpreted. When you assume a naturalistic origin to man, you automatically put yourself in the position of having to consider the implications of every fossil that is found, and new fossils are found every day. If you study the chart, the individuals listed are apes with characteristics suited for their habitat at the time. The author, Catherine Harmon, says, quote, "The jumble of fossil features emphasizes that evolution is a messy business," end of quote. In contrast to this highly complex puzzle of how physical features may have changed, the Bible identifies what really makes us human, which is not how we look physically, but our having been created in the image of God. Teacher fired for giving a student a Bible. In Phillipsburg, New Jersey, a teacher named Walter Tutka made an offhand comment to a student leaving his classroom in which he said, quote, "So, the last shall be first and the first shall be last," end of quote. The student asked where the statement came from and later asked again, so Tutka showed him the statement in his personal Bible. The student said he didn't own a Bible, so Tutka gave him his. The school district says that Tutka violated a rule that prohibits employees from distributing religious literature on school grounds, and also violated a rule saying the teachers must remain neutral while discussing religious materials. The system fired Tutka. The story has been on the web in several places. Apparently, Tutka was a substitute teacher, and there might have been other issues involved, but the message this sends is all too common. Atheists go to court to challenge tax exemptions for religious groups. David Silverman has announced in a public letter to members of the American Atheist dated December 21, 2012, that his group has filed a lawsuit, quote, "challenging the preferential treatment of religious nonprofit organizations by the United States tax code," end of quote. Claiming the church is being tax exempt violates the First and 14th Amendments. Silverman says they plan to make churches lose tax exemption status. "We expect this to be successful sooner or later. And when it happens, and churches have to start paying taxes on their income and their property, it will make huge changes in this country." It is religious groups that handle the homeless shelters, relief agencies, food pantries and kitchens, counseling services, nursing homes, hospitals, care facilities, and transportation services. Imagine the domino effect of religious groups having to close all of their services. It isn't atheists that do this work. We would suggest that Silverman and his ilk haven't thought this out very well. In a related issue, the Center for Inquiry, which publishes the magazine Skeptical Inquirer, has complained about President Obama's failure to, quote, "reform the federal government's faith-based funding programs as he promised in 2008, but he has actually increased money being expended on such programs," end of quote. This is from a public letter by Ronald A. Lindsay, President and CEO, dated 12-11-12. Alcoholism in women increases. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention says their data shows that 1 in 8 women in the United States drinks excessively. Because women tend to be smaller and therefore are more susceptible to the harm of alcohol, their data defines excessive as more than 3 drinks daily, or 7 per week, less than the accepted value for men. The Center reports that 23,000 women die every year from causes related to the use of alcohol. We continue to maintain that alcohol is the most destructive recreational drug on this planet, and that use of alcohol as such violates the biblical concept of viewing the body as the temple of God. 1 Corinthians 3, 16-17 and 6, 15-17. The data is from the week, January 25th, 2013, page 17. Superfruit and hunger. One of the unnecessary tragedies of planet Earth right now is the number of people who go to bed hungry every night. It is unnecessary because the food is available. Not only do we waste a huge amount of food, but we fail to use foods that are available. In Time Magazine, January 11, 2013, page 20, is a discussion of exotic fruits that have greater nutritional value than what we tend to use. The gac fruit, G-A-C is the name, of Southeast Asia, for example, has 70 times as much lycopene, that's an antioxidant good for heart health, as a tomato. The golden berry of South America has 2 grams of protein per serving. The mangosteen of Indonesia is high in vitamins A and C. The foods are there, but we have to use what is available and avoid wasting what we have been given. Fastest growing religion is none. The Pew Research Center reports that between 1972 and 1989, 7% of Americans identified themselves as having no religious affiliation. Between 1990 and 2012, that figure has jumped to 19.6%, and among people under the age of 30, that figure has jumped to over 30%. This does not mean that all of these are atheists, but it does mean that a growing number of people are not impressed with what churches are doing. In Houston, former pastor named Mike Oss has started an atheist church called the Houston Oasis. The group says, quote, "We are a secular alternative to traditional churches where people can find the same sense of community and involvement without requiring anyone to believe in supernatural concepts or entities," end of quote. The need for people to see the evidence for God's existence and the validity of the Christian system continues to grow. The drug issue and mental illness. Every day in the United States, 850 adults and 250 children are added to the federal government's disability benefit rolls because of mental illness. That is 365,000 per year. 10% of American kids are now taking psychiatric drugs. Between 1985 and 2007, spending on antidepressants and antipsychotics alone multiplied some 50 times, going from $503 million to more than $24 billion. This data and material is from the Blue Book of the American Psychiatric Association titled, quote, "The Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Illness, Anatomy of an Epidemic" by Robert Whitaker, and "Mad Science, The Disorders of American Psychiatry" by Stuart Kirk. There are all kinds of explanations for this, but the main problem is that our society tends to create disorders by its diagnostic techniques and definitions. The instability produced by our failure as a people to live as God has called us to live has multiple side effects. An interesting article on this subject is in the November 2012 issue of Citizens Magazine, page 19. Odds and numbers. In the January 2013 issue of Astronomy, page 11, there is an interesting article by Robert Berman on numbers and probability. Berman starts out with the old question of how long it would take for a million monkeys pounding on a million typewriters to type the phrase from Moby Dick, quote, "Call me Ishmael," end of quote. Berman comes up with 2,100 trillion years, or roughly 150,000 times longer than the most liberal estimate of the age of the universe. He also gives the number of atoms in the entire visible universe as 10 to the 80th power. Our point is that when you look at the calculations of chance, producing the things we see in the cosmos, the numbers are always vastly beyond 10 to the 80th power. The nature of chance and statistics says we are not the product of chance, but of an intelligence that had a reason for creating the creation. Confirmation of the speed of light. In September of 2011, an experiment on the Swiss-French border seemed to indicate that neutrinos were traveling faster than the speed of light. There was a lot of media attention to this announcement, and we even had some detractors send us some pointed messages, since we have used Einstein's work in many of our presentations. It has now been confirmed that last February, physicists found a faulty cable that has produced mistimed measurements, and that the speed of light has not been exceeded. Had this redefined been exceeded, the question would have been, quote, what do we learn from this, and how does it change our understandings, end of quote. It seems that Einstein was right after all. Data for this is from Discover Magazine, January 2, 2013, page 51. Exodus from Exodus. For the past 37 years or more, Exodus International has led in the struggle between Christianity and homosexuality. Members of Exodus, at least in the beginning, were former homosexuals, and the program attempted to help people who were gay become straight. One of the ways this was done was by reparative therapy, in which people were told that by following a particular program, they could change their sexual orientation. Professional psychiatric organizations have opposed all reparative therapy, claiming it doesn't work and it can do damage. Alan Chambers, who is the president of Exodus International, disavowed reparative therapy at the annual Gay Christian Network Conference in January of 2012, claiming to focus on discipleship rather than change. This has caused a large number of supporters of Exodus International to leave. John Warren, who has been a supporter of Exodus, says that this has changed Exodus to having an ambiguous message. There has been some abuse involved in reparative therapy, and while there are many different versions of it, none have been consistently effective. This is a complex issue, and there is a difference between living a destructive gay lifestyle and choosing to use one's energy constructively outside of any sexual relationship. For more on this issue, you might want to go to Christianity Today, December 2012, page 17. A reader comments about Big Bang article. The following was received from reader Calvin Hoggard. Quote, reading your article entitled God of the Big Bang, May, June 2012, brought to mind something I have thought about for many years. I started my engineering career operating satellite tracking stations for the Physical Science Laboratory of New Mexico State, under contract with the United States Navy. Timing was critical to accurate quality data. We used atomic clocks to calibrate our 11 crystal oscillator frequency generators. The atomic clocks were ultimately tuned by the stars. As I understand it, physics tells us that the explosions from the Ladyfinger firecracker to a hydrogen bomb created chaos, not order. So the Big Bang Theory wants us to believe that the largest explosion in history eventually organized itself, without outside influence, into order so precise that we can adjust our most accurate time-creating devices using its order? Fantastic. And with that, we come to the conclusion of this particular reading of the Does God Exist Bi-Monthly Journal for the Visually Impaired for May, June 2013. John Clayton has been your reader. I hope you have profited by these articles. And we will be back to you in 2 months with the next issue, the July-August issue. In the meantime, I hope you enjoy a wonderful summer and that the weather will be beautiful where you are and that God will bless you with health until we see you again.